The best time to think about death is when you are well and you can develop these practices that will then sustain you when your time comes.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, conversations and life lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. A few things in this life are certain. There's going to be change, there's going to be transitions, and ultimately, this physical body that we're living in is not permanent. Most of us don't talk about the end of our physical body or death because we're too busy living the lives that we have to their fullest. I once read that life is pleasant, death is peaceful, it's the transition that can be troublesome. My guest today has spent most of her career working to improve the care and expand choices for patients at the end of their lives. Catherine Tucker is an attorney who was lead counsel on two landmark cases that were decided by the United States Supreme Court. Most recently, she has become involved in the renaissance of psychedelics and their use in treating patients at the end of their lives. Particularly psilocybin has been shown to decrease fear and anxiety in patients that are transitioning. Though we don't talk about death, all of us probably have been touched by it. We've all lost perhaps a grandparent, a parent, a loved one, or know someone that has passed beyond. And we're all going to go through this transition, and maybe it's healthy to talk about it before we're in it. Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for joining me today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Barry.
I'm looking forward to it. So I always ask all of my guests, where are you at today? Where are you coming from?
I'm in the mountains of Washington State in the tiny little Bavarian town of Leavenworth, Washington. And we're known for beautiful mountains and the Wenatchee River runs right through the center of town.
I've been there, actually. I lived in Seattle for a few years. So Catherine, now... you're a yoga instructor and you're also attorney. Which one came first?
Oh, good question. I had practiced yoga intermittently as a young adult, including through law school, but I became a very dedicated practitioner about 30 years ago. So I was well into my legal practice by then, which has now been almost 40 years of practice. And I actually first came to the ranch as a yoga instructor. And then when I understood that presenters shared about their interesting day job, I came back as a presenter to do that and always loved being there.
Oh, wonderful. And I know you're back in February in 2026, so we're looking forward to that visit as well. Yeah. So now what I want to talk about is you've done a lot of work with psychedelics in the past. And what, especially when it comes to the terminally ill people and end-of-life practices, what got you interested in that topic in particular?
Yeah. Well, so my career for 37 years was in public interest advocacy to protect and expand the rights of dying people. And that work over that period of time involved a lot of different things. I was out in the forefront of the effort to create the option known as medical aid in dying, sometimes called death with dignity. I did a lot of work around how do we promote improved pain and symptom management? How do we make sure patients know about all their options and that their wishes are respected? And that was my career. And about 5 or 7 years ago, I started learning about the modern era clinical trials with psilocybin in particular, which is one of a number of psychedelic substances. And the studies were showing that people approaching end of life who had debilitating anxiety and depression, if they had a single guided dose with psilocybin, they had immediate, substantial, and sustained relief. And when I read that, I nearly fell off my chair because I knew that the missing tool in the palliative care toolbox was a tool for relief of non-physical suffering. And so I right away turned my attention. I had had no prior interest in psychedelic law or policy, but I turned my attention to how can we open access? And I've spent the last 5 years in that advocacy arena.
So I mean, we can go back before that. So even before you got interested in psychedelics, you were interested in people's their dignity in dying. So
yes,
where I don't know that many attorneys that pick that as their interest. What was the catalyst that made you start being interested in that when you started law practice?
Yeah, well, I saw it as a really important individual liberty, personal autonomy issue. And I, you know, is anything ever really random? I sort of randomly, as a very young attorney, stumbled upon the nation's first initiative campaign to pass a law that was called Death with Dignity. And that was in Washington State. I was practicing in Seattle. And I volunteered to be pro bono counsel to the campaign. And so that brought me into the arena, and the initiative came close but did not pass. It was the platform that was the springboard in Oregon a couple years later to become the first state to adopt such a law. But I was so compelled by the issue of empowering dying people with a compassionate choice. Because, of course, as you know, modern medicine can extend life, and now people can find themselves trapped in a dying process that they feel is taking too long. And so the choice to be able to precipitate a peaceful death is important. And and it's now increasingly widely available across the U.S., which is good. But then no one wants to think someone would choose that because they had unrelieved suffering. And hence my interest in psilocybin-assisted therapy.
I read that you had read an article by Michael Pollan that kind of helped move you in that direction. What was that article?
Yeah. So maybe some of your readers also love the New Yorker magazine.
For sure.
It was his article in the New Yorker called The Trip Treatment. And that article then was expanded into his book, which is a national bestseller called How to Change Your Mind. Many of you may have read that. And it's really quite wonderful because Michael, I know he's known to the ranch and to Deborah. He has a wonderful ability to take complicated things and make them so easily accessible to non-scientists. And he did that with that wonderful book, which then became a four-part Netflix series, also called How to Change Your Mind. But what Michael recounted in the article that really woke my attention was that a single guided session with psilocybin brought such immediate and enduring relief. So imagine you have a terminal illness, you're confronted with the reality of death soon. Not most of us think it will be sometime long away, but soon. And that brings you existential distress. Imagine being able to have a therapeutic session with this drug and feeling all that anxiety drain away and coming to peace with what is real for you in that moment. It just seemed so important to bring that to the bedside.
When you said twice now, a guided therapy session. So what does that mean? What does that entail?
Yes. That's a great question. So this is a drug that would not be a dispensary model. You would not go to your corner dispensary like people do with cannabis. This is a drug that has a very powerful impact on the consciousness of the person ingesting it. And while they are under the influence, they are with a person trained to sit with such a patient and help them experience it and kind of trip sit or take care of their body while they're having this very intense alteration of consciousness. Now, it is true that the person who might be the trip sitter could be a physician, it could be a mental health professional, or as is happening now in Oregon, which has a state legal program for psilocybin, it's simply someone who's taking a training module on how to successfully be a companion to someone who's taking that medication. The most important part that everyone points to with this drug is the therapy that follows with what's called the integration. And that's where the person who had ingested the drug would really talk with a skillful therapist about how to integrate the experience of having been with that drug into what they're dealing with.
So, and you said it's kind of an immediate relief of anxiety for someone. What is the chemical process that happens in the brain when you take
psilocybin? Yeah, so I'm not a scientist. I'm a lawyer. But in general, the reports are, and this is why this drug and similar drugs are so effective for a variety of mental health challenges. It takes the person out of their default mode. It helps them step out of a recurring cycle of depressive thought. Or it's also a drug that is being tested for relief, for example, of PTSD, where trauma puts someone in a locked room that they can't get out of. It's being tested for use with addiction, with substance abuse disorder, because it helps the person step out of a recurring cycle. It is a default reset, if you will. And in the context of a person with terminal illness, it's a default reset where the person has the experience of seeing their life in a much larger frame. And so the fear of death diminishes, and comfort with what the mystery of life and the mystery and wonder and beauty of life and what happens at death becomes more accessible.
What is the lasting effect of that? I mean, if a person has a month left to live and they do this treatment, do they need to do it again in like 2 weeks or?
Yeah, well, what's so interesting is the clinical trials have shown that the impact is enduring, that a single trip will be giving relief months later. Wow. And so they have done that where they've gone back to people and checked in. Are you still receiving the benefit of that experience? And the answer is yes. And so that's why it's so exciting. And it's not a drug that you need to take chronically. You don't need to keep taking it like a daily antidepressant.
Yeah. And just for listeners who might not know, it's derived from mushrooms, right? Certain kind of mushrooms, right?
Yes, from the psilocybin mushroom, And, you know, being in Mexico, as the ranch is, as you know, the ancient tradition in Mexico with this mushroom is a long and storied tradition. Mm-hmm. And we have much to thank the indigenous peoples of Mexico for bringing this medicine forward and into use. Yeah.
Right. What are some of the other psychedelics that are being used to treat people?
Yeah, there's a lot of excitement, and I've followed psilocybin most closely because it's been the drug shown both safe and effective with people with advanced illness. But there are ongoing trials with ibogaine, with LSD, with MDMA, with ayahuasca, and these are all other psychedelic substances. They all sit on Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act, which means they're only legally accessible for research. So if you're hearing about people doing these drugs in the U.S. now outside of a research setting, it is all in violation of law, of federal law, which is, you know, why the legal piece of this is so important, trying to promote a federal safe harbor.
What are the legal options that a patient would have right now?
Yeah, so there are some states, Oregon, and then Colorado, and very soon New Mexico. Those states have stepped forward to adopt state legalized programs. They provide no federal safe harbor. So in Oregon, where they have an up and running psilocybin program, you would be legal under state law, but still in violation of federal law. And so it's really quite risky to participate. Many veterans, and this is really quite sad, who are at risk of suicide due to PTSD are leaving the U.S. to go to places like Mexico, or Jamaica, or South America, where these substances are legal. And I always feel that it's wrong that someone who served their own country now must leave that country to get the care they need. And that's why veterans have really stepped forward as one of the strongest voices for reform. And that's driving a lot of the interest in federal policy reform.
Right. So currently, if I was in the United States and I say I lived in a state other than the ones you mentioned, they would be treating me with anxiety medicines and...
Yes. And see, that's the thing is, you know, this is why in the U.S. the FDA has twice granted psilocybin what's called breakthrough therapy status, which is only given to an investigational drug when the FDA concludes it is offering benefits that existing drugs don't. And that's the problem with existing antidepressants is for a lot of people, they simply don't work. Right. And hence the need to have a new tool in the toolbox.
Yeah. And I mean, personally, I mean, I'm not a scientist either, but it seems like the psilocybin is the same thing as a chemical drug that people are giving them for anxiety. You know what I mean? It's in the same family. I don't understand what the difference people see differently, but I imagine that they
do.
Yeah.
Well, the process for approving new drugs is long and slow, and we're kind of stuck in that now. I would say, though, apropos of your comment, and I like to always remind people of this, especially people who know and love the ranch, who may have, while they've been at the ranch, been exposed to wonderful practices like yoga, like meditation, like mantra. All of these practices bring about the change in consciousness and elevate and expand consciousness in the same way that psychedelic drugs do. And so I don't want anyone to leave this podcast thinking you can only achieve those states through psychedelic drugs. I really invite people to explore yoga tradition practices mm-hmm. with the breath, practices with asana, practices on your meditation cushion, because those are all through the very ancient history of India, which gave birth to those practices. Those are all accessible to everyone and they're legal everywhere. Right. And they give you so many benefits in addition to this relief of anxiety and depression.
Yeah. I feel like in our culture, we don't like to face death or talk about death or anything related to death.
Yeah.
Like it's not going to happen to us at some point.
You know, I'll tell you a funny story about that, Barry. So as you know, and as all your guests who come to the ranch know, most people fly into San Diego and get on the bus, and you all ride on the bus for that hour-long ride. And when I first was a presenter at the ranch, I did a program that I love to offer, and it's called Preparing for the Final Asana, Law and Medicine at the End of Life, and What Yoga Has to Offer. And I offer that at many other retreat centers, such as Kripalu and White Lotus. And I brought it to the ranch. And one of the days I was riding on the bus, everyone gets their brochure of the week's programs. And I heard the gal sitting behind me say, who wants to talk about death and dying? And it was exactly as you say. And and I have evolved the program that I bring to the ranch a bit so that we are now talking about psychedelics in a number of my presentations. And we're talking less about death and dying, because it's true, even at the ranch, people are there to think about wellness. What I like to remind people, though, is the best time to think about death is when you are well and you can develop these practices that will then sustain you when your time comes. And so having some awareness that death is a real fact of life can really catalyze your delight in the wonder and the beauty and the magic of this lifetime. Yeah. And then you're all the more happy to be here and enjoying your wellness.
My name is Sue, and we're from San Diego.
Yeah, my name is Victor. And this is our first time at Rancho La Puerta. We were recommended this wellness retreat by some of our close friends who were just first-time guests last year.
They're here with us. Mm-hmm.
And so far, it's been an amazing experience.
When they told us about this place, we were intrigued by the fact that it's only 90-minute drive from San Diego, yet you can feel completely disconnected. It's a whole week of program that you focus on the well-being of not just your physical health, but also your inner health as well. It has been truly transformative.
Yeah, and I really have been enjoying the kind of the guided hikes, the educational courses and lectures, and the exercise program.
Mm-hmm.
Picked up a lot of new activities while I've been here. Learned to play pickleball. Reminded myself how to play tennis again. So it's been a lot of stuff that we don't have time for because our lives are so busy. It's nice to have protected time just to, take care of ourselves and really take care of ourselves.
Yeah, we're going back tomorrow. We'll definitely return.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely come back.
Yeah.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I hope you are enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. Now, tell me who Roland Griffiths is.
Yeah, so Roland Griffiths, may he rest in peace or may he be on to his next lifetime. He recently died of cancer, but Roland Griffiths is recognized as the foremost modern era researcher to ignite and initiate the new clinical trials with psychedelics. He did it at Johns Hopkins, one of the leading research institutes in the world. And his research was very rigorous and very respected. And it really is what started what I refer to, and many do, as the psychedelic renaissance, which is a broad-based interest at other research institutes, among the research community, and in the general public about the potential for these really powerful and important medicines.
Right.
And so then he died. I mean, what was really so interesting is here's a researcher who had researched the value of psilocybin in patients with advanced cancer, found it was incredibly valuable, and then got himself a terminal cancer diagnosis.
Wow.
Yeah. And
I imagine he used it towards the end of his life.
Yes, he did. And he had some very wonderful interviews, including with stellar interviewers like Oprah and others, where he talks about coming to terms with that diagnosis. And, one of the wonderful things about Roland is I met him before his diagnosis, and I remember sitting with him because I had heard he had a very long-standing and dedicated meditation practice. And I sat with him and I said, Roland, I know this about you, and I also revere those practices. And I wonder if you think it would be optimum if people cultivated those practices rather than taking the drug. And he said, yes, of course. But if you're a dying person who hasn't done so and you come to the end of your life, this drug will do for you what maybe 30 years on your cushion might have. So he was very aware that there were a variety of ways to get to the place of coming to peace with your death. And he was very open, and he was an educator to the last bit of his life in sharing what it was to come with that diagnosis after having worked in the field.
Right. So I'm assuming that you believe it's a constitutional right that Americans have to die with dignity.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, because, of course, my early part of my career, I focused very much on trying to establish that the choice of a dying patient for a more peaceful death was the kind of deeply personal decision that should be protected by the U.S. Constitution guarantee of liberty, and the penumbra of privacy. And I took two cases through the federal courts to the U.S. Supreme Court in the mid-1990s that made that argument. And we had won those cases in the lower courts and felt really excited about seeing the U.S. Supreme Court expand the precedent governing individual decision-making and autonomy to cover this choice. Mm-hmm. And what the Supreme Court did was say, we might do that in the future. We're not going to do it today. And so it very carefully reserved the possibility of a future recognition. But it kind of punted the issue back to the states, which the court sometimes does, mm-hmm. and said, let's let the states grapple with this. And the states, as you may know, then almost immediately, through some of the work I and others were engaged with, started passing state laws. And Oregon was first, and then we saw Washington, Colorado, California, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, so many states, Hawaii, have all now respected that choice. And then I would say that as a matter of federal constitutional law, if any of your watchers are lawyers or are following what's happening in the federal arena, the Supreme Court has changed a lot in recent years. And it's very, very unlikely to find a new privacy or liberty interest in this with this bench.
Right. But you could, if you live in one of the states that you mentioned, it's available to you.
Yes. And in fact, many of the states also are willing for patients to come in from a neighboring state. You know, if you're living in Massachusetts, which does not respect this choice, but Maine and Vermont do, you may find yourself crossing border to achieve that.
Yeah. So what is the mental capacity that's required for you to make those decisions?
Yeah, so it was always seen as really important that the decision be made by a person with the ability to make their own informed decisions. So all of the state laws require that the person has intact decision-making capacity. So this is not a choice that is available for people with advanced dementia, for example. For that population, and I get this question at every conference I ever speak
at. Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
You know, people worry about dementia. They worry that they will persist for a long time in an advanced state of dementia. There's a special form of advanced directive for that, advanced directive for dementia, where the person can specify, if I can no longer X, and I can no longer recognize my spouse, my instructions are no food and fluid by any means, maximum comfort support. And then the person knows that they will achieve death within a relatively short period of time. Mm-hmm. That's how those people can avoid a prolonged decline in dementia. Mm-hmm. But you have to think about it early before that window slams shut on mm-hmm. your decision-making capacity.
Right.
Don't delay.
Yeah, which means we have to face the fact that we might die. Right.
Yeah.
I think we're talking a lot about the law and different states, but I think people can relate to personal stories. I read a story about a person named Erin that you worked with. Can you maybe tell a little bit about her?
Yes, Erin. I think you're referring to Erin Baldeschweiler. So
yes.
Erin, when I started working in the arena of opening access to psilocybin-assisted therapy, I was working with a physician based in Seattle, Dr. Sunil Agarwal, and he has an integrative oncology clinic, the Advanced Integrative Medical Science Institute. And at that clinic, he treats people with advanced cancer, and one of his patients was Erin Baldeschweiler. And Erin was very willing to talk about her story publicly, and she has done so. She was diagnosed with advanced cancer as a relatively young person in her 50s. She was single mother to two children still living at home. And so Erin was looking at the particularly difficult reality that she would not live to see her children achieve adulthood. And that gave rise, as you can imagine, to a lot of grief and loss and sadness, anxiety, and depression. And Dr. Agarwal treats patients with ketamine, which is worth mentioning. That is a psychedelic adjacent drug that's very much in the public eye because it has many of the benefits of psychedelic substances. And it is legally available and widely available. And Dr. Agarwal uses that at his clinic and had offered that to Erin, but she still wanted psilocybin therapy for its additional benefits. So she became a plaintiff in one of the lawsuits that we brought against the DEA. And if you can imagine having the burdens, not just of being a single mom, but then also with an advanced cancer diagnosis, deciding to contribute your time and energy to be part of a lawsuit, that's really an amazing devotion of public service to trying to make things better for other people. Mm-hmm. And Erin actually came to Washington, D.C. to a demonstration that happened on the doorstep of the DEA and demonstrated with placards and chanting to try to get the DEA to move forward on rescheduling psilocybin and opening access. And I was there and I witnessed Erin being handcuffed and put in the police wagon and taken to jail for that civil demonstration. Now, they were released and charges were ultimately dropped. But what a brave soul to be willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, Barry, we've probably all seen a loved one at this point. You know, if you've reached the age of 50, I don't know how old you are, but if you've gotten close to that age, you've probably seen a grandparent, a parent, maybe a spouse or a sibling go through an advanced illness. And we all want that person to be at peace. Mm-hmm. And so I think people do feel really strongly about why can't we bring an additional tool to the bedside that is shown to bring peace? Let's do that. Let's get this done.
Right. So is there a backlash of people that think that you know, people are just want to use it recreationally?
Yeah, I mean, you know, interestingly enough, if you look at what happened in Oregon, the law that was passed there is an adult use law. They did not choose to restrict it to medicinal use. And yet it still passed at the ballot box. It was a citizen initiative. So, you know, it's hard to know if people oppose recreational use when you see things like that. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I think if you were to poll, support for therapeutic medicinal use would be very high. And that's what I've been advocating for.
I wonder why. I mean, I guess there's no answer to this. Why are certain states like Oregon so progressive in this way, and yet other states aren't? It's just interesting to me.
It is so interesting. And of course, Oregon was a pioneer with the Death with Dignity Act, and now it's pioneered with psilocybin. You know, some people, some political watchers comment that it could be due to religious affiliation. Oregon is known as kind of the least religious, the least churchy of all the 50 states. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You often will see religious leaders reluctant to embrace individual liberties. And that's been true in reproductive freedom. It's been true in end of life liberty. Mm-hmm. It's been true with access to drugs that alter consciousness.
What is the end of life liberty project that you are a founder of?
So my career, I have hopscotched from one nonprofit to the next, kind of always looking for where can I do the most impactful work. So I was for many years with a group called Compassion and Choices, which was where I did the Death with Dignity advocacy. And then I went across an interesting aisle and I took the opportunity to be with a group called the Disability Rights Legal Center, mm-hmm. the nation's oldest and largest disability rights advocacy group. Mm-hmm. And I did that because one of the voices that has been powerful in opposing end-of-life liberty and aid in dying has been the disability community, with the concern that because people with disabilities often are stigmatized and marginalized, that if we allow dying people the choice for medical aid in dying, suddenly that choice might be forced on people with disabilities. I wanted to be at a disability group to try to build some bridges between the disability rights community and the end-of-life community, because at their bedrock, they have the same foundational commitment to empowering the individual to be in control of their life. So I moved there, and while I was at the Disability Rights Legal Center, I created the End-of-Life Liberty Project as a sub-project within the disability rights group. And then I eventually moved it out of there, and it was a standalone entity. And then I moved myself over to the National Psychedelics Association to undertake this psychedelic advocacy.
So it sounds to me like if people want to get involved and make a difference, at this point with the current political climate, the best thing to do is get involved on a state level.
Well, I mean, many things to be said about that. There was just last week, to show you how timely this is, the introduction of a bipartisan bicameral bill that would open access to some psychedelic-assisted therapy. It's called the Freedom to Heal Act, and you can go about and Google it and lean in supporting that act. That is... It's another effort. There have been a number of efforts to get a federal bill through the federal Congress that would open access. Interestingly, in this current environment, we have seen the leadership of the involved agencies all speak publicly in support of access to psychedelics for these difficult mental health problems. So RFK at HHS has been a supporter. The leadership at the Veterans Administration, the leader of the Food Drug Administration, all of these federal agency leaders have said positive things about opening access. And the chance for them to put some real movement to that intention is the petition that I have pending in front of HHS right now to reschedule psilocybin. And that's been sitting on the desk at HHS. You may have noticed with the federal government shutdown, maybe not much is getting done, but we could see movement on that petition any day. And I'd love it if when I came to the ranch in February, I could say, our petition has moved forward. Mm-hmm. So stay on the edge of your seat because that could happen.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you'll be here the week of February 7th.
Correct? Yes, right up until Valentine's Day.
Yes. And are you going to do, what is your presentation will be?
It's the psychedelic renaissance. And So I will be speaking several times as we do across the week. Love for as many guests as possible to join me. There's always the hazard at the ranch is there's too much good stuff to do.
Yeah, yeah.
People feel pulled in many directions. But I'd love for people to come and learn about what I plan to do is do a big overview of what are these drugs, what are their potential applications, where do they currently stand in the pipeline for accessibility, and kind of do a landscape overview. And then I'll have a couple of breakout sessions later in the week. One of them will be to take a deep dive into the law, policy, and advocacy. And the other will be to talk about psychedelics in the framework of what can we achieve through other practices that bring us to a similar space. So we'll talk about yoga. We'll talk about meditation, mantra, pranayama, practices that maybe many ranch guests already have in their wheelhouse or want to really ramp up.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. I think, you know, sometimes we think when we're not faced with something directly that it's going to be okay. So you had mentioned your friend, how, you know, he did his meditation practice for all those years, but you know, at the very end, sometimes we might need some extra help.
Yes. You know, one of my teachers that I revere, maybe many of your guests know him, Frank Ostaseski. Mm-hmm. He wrote the wonderful book, The Five Invitations, and he has been longtime leader of the Zen Hospice in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And he sat with hundreds and hundreds of dying patients. And I recently had the privilege of being on retreat with him, and he has had a number of really serious medical challenges. And I asked him privately or kind of, you know, at a mealtime, whether he found his practices in the Buddhist tradition sustained him when he was on the other side of the sheet, as he likes to say.
Yeah.
And what he said was, what really helped him was just kind of repeating the mantra, this is what is happening right now.
Yeah.
You know, and just taking the smallest slice of, this is what is happening right now. Right now, it's like this.
Yeah.
And that helped him get through the crisis. But, you know, I think we all wonder, will our practices sustain us? And we hope they will.
Mm-hmm.
And we practice both for the benefit of the practice today and that it may serve us in future when we really need it.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, thanks for taking the time out of your day to speak with me today. And
such a pleasure.
I look forward to
seeing you in person on that lovely campus.
Yeah,
I can't wait to see you. Fresh new year.
I'm so looking forward to it.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. See you soon. Time is such an abstract concept. I can remember being a kid, I couldn't wait for time to go by faster. So when my birthday would arrive, soon it would be Christmas, or that I'd be old enough to drive a car. It doesn't matter what we do or what we wish, time goes by. We don't know what hand will be dealt, but ultimately we know the game is going to end. My conversation with Catherine today was comforting. I hadn't really thought about psychedelics and their use to expand one's mind, decrease fear and anxiety. Catherine reminded me that it's all of our human right to make choices about our lives, even the end of our lives. Catherine will be here on February 7th for a week, and she will be sharing her journey, what she's witnessed and learned, and how it all aligns with her meditation and yoga practice. Until I see you again, I wish you a life lived fully with joy, peace, and a loving acceptance of this journey.